Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, we'll be looking at what's going on with the family court system after shocking statistics revealed that over 100,000 children are currently trapped in the system due to backlogs.
We'll also be looking at Labour's proposed plans to give victims of stalking the right to know the identity of their abuser as part of a wider look at whether the legislation is fit for purpose.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first, it's The Week Unwrapped.
We face an almighty challenge to hit these milestones by the end of this Parliament. Like I say, we're starting from ground zero. Waiting lists over 7 million. Housing starts and permission the lowest for a decade. One in three children not ready for school at the age of five. And that's kids in reception who aren't starting to read, they're struggling to speak, and, you know, in fact, given our inheritance, let's say, on housing starts, clearly, if we don't turbocharge house building with reform, we won't meet that milestone. And if that level of candour surprises you, then honestly, it shouldn't. After all, what is the point of setting a target that you can deliver without bold action? That's not public service. That's political cynicism. No, the job of these milestones is to take our country forward, drive reform through the public sector. It's not about making the government look good. So, yes, they are risky for us. Country first, party second. Because that is something we've totally lost sight of in British politics. And to be honest, across Whitehall as well.
In what has been described by the Conservatives as a relaunch of his premiership, Keir Starmer has announced his six priorities for government in a key Plan for Change speech. The milestones included housing, which was a target to build 1.5 million homes and fast-track planning decisions on more than 150 major economic infrastructure projects. Living standards, a promise to raise living standards in every part of the UK, putting more money in working people's pockets and delivering the highest sustained growth in the G7. A pledge to hire 13,000 more police officers, PCSOs and special constables for the streets, as well as a named officer for every neighbourhood. A target to meet the NHS standard for 92% of patients in England to wait no more than 18 weeks for treatment. A promise to secure homegrown energy to put the UK on track to deliver at least 95% clean power by 2030. A commitment to give children the best start in life by ensuring a record 75% of five-year-olds ready to learn when they start school. One notable omission was migration, something Labour had previously stated was a top priority. OK, Ali, what did you make of Keir Starmer's speech? Was this a government reset?
Yeah, it was definitely a reset. I'm going to do positives and then negatives, right? I like the new framing of success being a result of living standards, because I think when we talk about things like growth, that doesn't make... You know, you can have growths in all different kinds of industries and areas, but the real importance is, do people feel the economy is getting better? Mm. Are the lives of people improving? If you look at living standards, and the other measure that me and you have spoken about on the show is happiness, like societal happiness. Britain is on a downward trajectory, both in living standards and happiness, compared to not even just European counterparts, but European and global countries as a whole. So I like the measurement being... living standards and improving people's living standards being something to hold the government to account on. That being said, what I don't like is the communication strategy that's going on here, and that has been the central tenet of what the government has got wrong from the beginning. Because as you and I have said, some of the policy has been quite good, but the comms of it all is terrible, and I'll tell you why. First of all, this is like the third or fourth sort of missions or lists of things that he has announced. Mm. My view of political comms is it's most effective when it's a story. What you want to do is tell people a story about who you are and why you're doing the things that you're doing, and then everything cascades from that. The problem is, I don't think Keir Starmer has defined what this government's sort of story is. And the best example that I can point to as to why that's important, if you look at America, new polling, I think released by Politico, has shown people's attitudes towards various different things have changed since Trump won the presidency. So people who thought who had a negative view of the economy now have a positive view of the economy, even though he's not in office yet and nothing's changed. 9 in 10 Americans Republican / Trump voters thought that electoral fraud was an issue. After he won, that turned to only just over a third of them thinking electoral fraud was an issue. The reason that was is because Trump has told a story about himself. He is the anti-establishment sort of fighting against the political class. Everything he does as a consequence of that, from a comms perspective, kind of becomes irrelevant to the story that he's told. It's not a story to kind of list things. No great communications plan or campaigns has ever been run on a plan. It's been run on visions, stories, emotions, and that's what I think Starmer's project has been missing from the outset.
So,
what do you think, though? That's what I'm interested. Do you think it'll connect?
I agree with you. No, I think what is missing is a coherent vision and narrative about what Starmerism is. You know, you look at Tony Blair, he had education. Boris Johnson had levelling up, although you can obviously argue about whether he cared about that.
Yeah.
Liz Truss presumably had destroying the economy. You know, everyone has their thing. What is Keir Starmer's thing? Now, I think for a while it was supposed to be building. If that is a story, it was get Britain building again, and it was spades in the ground. It was more housing. It was more infrastructure projects. It was making the UK an energy superpower with this new Great British Energy. But it's either that's got diluted, or they've abandoned it, or they've forgot that they still need to paint a picture.
Yeah.
And I don't think that... I understand why building is really important, but I don't think it's good enough on its own to be the story. For me, there's a really obvious story that needs to be told, but it requires a government that I think is far braver than this. And that's one about generational inequality.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, we look at how the farmers responded to inheritance tax and how the country responds to inheritance tax. You can see that the British public care a lot about passing things down to the next generation. They care a lot about their kids. There is a story you can tell here, which is unless we sort out the generational inequalities within the economy, within housing, within pensions, within care, not only will your children suffer, but you will suffer because there will be no one here to look after you. It's redistribution, yes, and it would involve a government that wants to tax, but also one that wants to invest in not just education, not just social care, but also things like retirement villages. You know, the message should be, we will look after you when you're old and we will lift you up and empower you when you're young.
Yeah, and if that's so key, because if that's the top line message, if the story of this government is fixing the inequality that 14 years of Tory government sort of ramped
into the fabric of
our society. Even more, you're right. Probably 40 years, but I don't want to get the Blair lot on in my mentions. But if the story is overall tackling inequality and making Britain fair, and that's your top line messaging, then all of these different milestones that he's talking about would come underneath that.
Mm.
The problem is, currently, he doesn't have that top line, so then it all becomes about these milestones. And I don't know if people actually connect. So ordinary people who aren't like me and you or like the I'm going to call them normal people. We're still normal. But like people who aren't in politics aren't going to look at this and go, yep. They're not going to emotionally connect to it in the way that he wants. It needs to have a top story, a sort of emotional thing to connect you. And then you can go, you know, building new homes is part of making Britain fairer again. Raising living standards is part of making Britain fairer. Safe streets, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I agree. And like the problem is, if you don't have an overarching narrative, if you don't have a clear vision that the country feel you're working towards, when you do things like taking away your nan's winter fuel payment, people will go, well, what's that for? Why? Yeah. I don't understand. And you know, if your message is things are going to be really shit for ages, even in 10 years' time, people are going to go, well, can't my nan at least have her winter fuel payment back? You know? Yeah. So you have to give a vision that people can buy into. Mm-hmm. And I think what's happened here, and possibly you'll know a bit more about this than me because you are more insidery in the Labour Party than I am. But my feeling is that Labour got very wrapped up during campaigning, pre-election, of this idea that what Brits wanted was just security and stability. They wanted a government that butted out. They just wanted to know that their money was secure, their housing was secure, their borders are secure, their kids are secure, and they were sick of the political changing and the, you know, the corruption and the sleaze, and they just wanted to hear less.
Chaos,
and they wanted a government that worked for them. And what they took from that was they don't want any gimmicks. They don't want anything radical. They just want a government that gets on with the hard jobs and rolls up its sleeves. I think that is a misreading of that. I think actually there is an appetite for radicalism. We saw it in the general election. People are very, very aware that things are broken. If you say everything's broken and then you come in and say, but we're not going to do anything major to fix it, I think it really undermines your message.
Yeah. So I think you're right. Labour took a very safe pair of hands strategy in the election because they rightly saw that people were done with the Conservative Party and all Labour needed to do was do no harm, essentially, in order to get yourself into government. That worked. The issue that I have is the strategy is entirely and consistently reactive. Mm. So Labour is terrified of a number of things right now, and I know this for an absolute fact. They're terrified of reform on immigration. And they have, for about 15 years, been terrified of a poll polls that consistently show that people don't trust Labour on the economy after what they perceived to be Labour overspending into the 2008 crash. So, as a result, rather than, in my view, building their own narrative about what this Labour government can be, from the moment you get elected, the campaign is over. Mm. Now you have to tell the story of your government. Instead, they're still reacting as if they're doing rebuttals on the campaign trail. So Starmer's sort of speech and going hard on immigration is not going to work. Mm. You are not going to out Nigel Farage and Nigel Farage. You're not going to out immigration reform. So you have to tell a different story, right? And that's where on inheritance tax, if you are bold in telling a different story, you can win people over. Mm. How many people in this country actually own property or land over £3 million farms, right? If you actually told the story of inequality and told your own story about what your government is, then you could be far more radical and bold in the things that you do. We always tell this to people. I do it when I run some of my media sessions or comm sessions. People don't remember what you say. They remember how it made them feel. Mm. Right? And that's where all of this statistical stuff you need to get rid of and you need to tell a central story.
So if we go back to this idea of inequality, right? Take inheritance tax. Why aren't they saying very, very loudly? The problem is, and this is what you and I talked about on the podcast, the problem is that when there is a tax loophole there, it exploits it, it drives up the price of land values, it makes it unfair, and it keeps this perpetual cycle going of very, very wealthy people buying up this land and pricing you out. They are not telling that story. And the way to tell that
story
is...
that's because it's proactive.
And the way to tell that story is to go even further and say, okay, if we left it, here's where you would be, you and your family would be in 50 years' time. They aren't doing that. Same with the winter fuel, right? You can understand the rationale for trying to means test winter fuel because pensioners are the wealthiest generation. Why are they all getting mass handouts? But they're not making that. They're not making that argument. They're just saying, oh, well, we need to claw back what we can a little bit here and there, but it's not going to make a difference because everything's so messed up. Yeah. It's not a convincing story.
No, it's because the communication strategy is entirely rebuttal and reactionary. Mm. So rather than getting on the front foot, and we all know this, in politics, if you're not on the offense, you're on the defensive. Mm. And Labour is consistently on the defensive. So rather than, like you're saying, on winter fuel or on farms, going out and saying, if we don't do this, this will happen. This is why we're doing it, because we believe in this. Mm. Rather than that, they're saying, here's why us getting rid of winter fuel isn't terrible, or here's why it's not terrible. That is a reactive, defensive political communication strategy that's not going to work. Because if I come to you and I say, Zoe, don't think of elephants, don't think of elephants, don't think of elephants. Mm. The only thing you're going to think of is elephants. Mm. And so unless Labour tell their own story, proactive, brave, bold, and painting in colours rather than in numbers, it's not going to connect. Mm. And that's, again, going back to this, people don't remember what you say, they remember how it made them feel. If we, for example, some of the big speeches and big political sort of communication moments in history, like MLK, sort of I Have a Dream, which I often use as an example, no one remembers the rest of that speech. Mm. There's not a single other line that people know from that speech. Why? Because they remember how I Have a Dream made them feel. Mm. I Have a Dream is not a particularly punchy line or... And I know I'm going really top level here, but that's the problem with this strategy. Because people... I guarantee you most people listening at home won't look at these milestones and measure Labour against them. No one will remember these numbers in 6 weeks' time. The other problem we have that I want to ask you is, let's forget about what Labour should be doing in terms of proactive comm strategy. What do people think of Keir now? Mm. What if you ask the layman in terms of who they think he is and what his government is, what do they think?
I think they find him boring and insipid.
Does this change that?
No.
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 Unless
but,
he changes
but
that.
But I wonder if he just isn't quite the right man to be offering the vision, you know? That is my issue. And I feel like this is very managerial. This is very kind of, you know, rolling up your sleeves and getting on with the hard jobs. But I think the country's past that.
Mm.
And that's my concern.
They seem to be past him. That's the worry I have. Is I am really, really worried. And I've said this on this show with you numerous times. When people make up their mind about you, it's over.
Do you think they've missed the boat to turn around who Keir Starmer is? Can he become a visionary?
He can never become a pure political orator. That's not him. That's not who he is. He's actually a pretty poor public speaker and media performer, if I'm honest, right? It sounds like I'm super anti him. I'm not. That's not his skill set. But then his comms people have to provide him with the necessary sort of strategy to mitigate that, and they're just not doing it.
Okie doke. Well, that is The Week Unwrapped. Coming up, we'll be speaking to a domestic abuse survivor and campaigner about Labour's proposed plans to tell stalking victims the identity of their abuser. That's next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUPAR Radio.
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the crying, truth.
Crying.
And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle.
It is.
I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you, what's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the
crying,
truth.
Crying.
And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle.
It is.
I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, the Minister for Safeguarding, Jess Phillips, has announced proposed plans to inform victims of stalking the identity of their abusers. So, I'm going to say all that again. I got it wrong. Now the Minister of Safeguarding, Jess Phillips, has announced proposed plans to inform victims of stalking the identity of their abuser at the earliest opportunity. This change is part of a wider government plan to give stalking victims more protection. Other proposed policy changes include a review of stalking legislation to see if the law can be changed further to support police to spot stalking and arrest offenders, defining stalking in a statutory guidance and setting out a legal framework to help support services work together, and making stalking protection orders, which can ban alleged stalkers from contacting or being within a certain distance of their victims, more widely available. According to official figures, about 1 in 5 women aged 16 or above in England and Wales have been a victim of stalking at least once. Well, joining us on our programme to discuss this is Zoe Dronfield, a campaigner, author and domestic abuse survivor. Zoe, thank you so much for joining us today. Tell me, are these proposed plans, in your view, a step in the right direction?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely welcomed and a step in the right direction. However, again, I don't think they go far enough. You know, the fact that that victims will be able to, it'll be revealed to them who the stalker is, that's a great step. Because obviously, if you're blind to that information, that's even more unnerving, and that's exactly what the stalker wants. But I think for a long time, and for almost 10 years, I've been campaigning for serial stalkers and domestic abusers to be put on a register like sex offenders, so that the police can monitor and track those individuals proactively. And a lot of the laws that are in place at the moment rely on the victim having to make that move. And I think that, you know, by nature of their offending, they offend and escalate at a high rate. And without that being that pattern and escalation being monitored, then they just continue with impunity. Mm.
Zoe, can I ask you, I'm interested as well as sort of, I guess, in-person physical, also online stalking that happens. Mm-hmm. Do you think enough is being done to kind of widen the scope of what police action can be and authority action can be in the online space as well? Because it can be it can feel equally as intrusive being stalked online as it can in person.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that we really should start thinking about legislating those social media platforms, because that's where, you know, the majority of the stalking happens. And, you know, without them on board and coming to the table and putting in place, you know, stipulations, what would happen if somebody is being stalked online and via their platform, then, you know, the police are going to struggle with that. You know, the internet is wide and vast, isn't it? And there's many platforms to, you know, and particularly in my case, you know, he used every platform he could to get contact with me. And it is unnerving.
Zoe, obviously you've spoken a lot about your story, very, very courageously spoken about what happened to you at the hands of, I believe it was it an ex-partner of yours?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think you told the BBC that you felt that the officers were not sufficiently trained to recognise that he was a danger to you. Can you talk a little bit more about that and whether you think that actually more needs to be done to train police officers or potentially stamp out maybe biases they have when it comes to dealing with stalkers?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, so to start off with, yes, absolutely. They do need training because it's no good having a law if the police don't know how to use it. And what we've got to remember is they're a jack of all trades and a master of none. You know, they have to turn up to a 999 call not knowing what they're going to be faced with. And if they haven't got training on the complexities of domestic abuse and stalking, you know, they're very, very intricate. It's a very intricate crime, you know, because something as, you know, innocent as placing a bunch of flowers on a doorstep might seem unremarkable on its own. However, if you then find out that individual has a history of stalking, has maybe a protection order against them, and this pattern is them breaking those and breaching those orders and boundaries, then that's a problem. Now, what I struggle with in the current system is how are they actually documenting that pattern and escalation in behaviour? You know, I think it very much is a postcode lottery. And particularly in my case, when I called the police because my stalker and abuser was turning up at the door, the two male police officers that turned up started to make jokes and said, oh, you need to find yourself a nice boyfriend. It wasn't a laughing matter. You know, I was actually, no one calls 999. You know, if you're calling 999, it's serious. You know, right? We don't call it for a joke, do we? So to turn up and actually start making jokes was quite unprofessional. But then I was also then trying to show them the evidence and get them to listen to voicemails that were being played to me to them, sorry. My abuser was leaving voicemails threatening to kill himself. That's a prerequisite to homicide. Mm. So that is a huge red flag. They didn't recognise this. So, you know, over the last 10 years, obviously, I've absorbed myself in this kind of crime and understand it. But surely that's what the police should recognise, those kind of things. So it's OK bringing in the law, but unless they're trained sufficiently and regularly, how will it help?
And can I just ask you, Zoe, as well, just so our listeners kind of understand, because it almost seems slightly strange to suggest that people might not know the identity of their stalkers because you kind of feel like they're always, you know, in your presence. How is it that it can be that someone would not know the identity of their stalker already? What sort of situation would that happen in?
So I think that's when we're talking about that kind of stalker, it's a stranger stalker. So maybe it's somebody that you've had, it's an acquaintance, or maybe you've had a passing moment with them, or it could be maybe you've, for example, like Jess Phillips. Jess Phillips has been stalked. She's, a public figure, so would be no, but she wouldn't necessarily know who her stalker is if she's receiving kind of stuff online, they're made up accounts and things like that. So I think in that specific situation.
Zoe, can I ask, I want to just take you quickly back to the police, because it's something we've consistently heard, particularly with gender-based crimes and violence. Police training, lack of understanding. Also, we've seen some horrific things said by police officers in the public realm, and that no doubt impacts women's confidence in dealing with the police. I assume we don't currently have a division dealing with things like stalking and gender-based violence. Should we have a division within our national police force that focuses on this, like we have a counter-terrorism unit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd be all for that. I mean, we do have police officers that specialise in domestic abuse and stalking. So each force will have somebody there, but it isn't a department, and I don't believe, but absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they are just putting in a domestic abuse specialist in the 999 call centre. So that's a pilot at the moment. So we'll have to see how that goes. If the police aren't trained on this kind of crime, then some of the crimes that are reported will seem unremarkable and as if it's, wasting police time. And you've even had situations where a victim's been charged with wasting police time and then ended up being murdered. And it just beggars belief, really, because there's never just one offence. There is always a pattern. And if they're allowed to get away with it, it will escalate. And I really think that, my petition online that's serial stalkers, to include serial stalkers on a register like sex offenders, is on change.org. It's got nearly 280,000 signatures. Most people, the public, believe that this is a thing already. They can't believe that actually if somebody's got a history of an offence, domestic abuse and stalking, how would they not join that up? And they don't join it up.
And
that's a problem.
Sorry, what's the reaction been like? I assume you engage with policymakers, MPs, governments. What's the reaction been to that specific idea of putting serial stalkers on a register, public register?
So the Conservative government always pushed back. I mean, we got it debated in Parliament many times and it ping-ponged between the two houses. Labour have said, and verbally given us that we are going to do this. When that will happen, I don't know. And it's great that you asked me that question, because, it's a question that I'd like an answer to as well. So, I really do think, yes, they talk about these protection orders being robust. In my opinion, they're not, because it is just a piece of paper. What happened in my case is, when the stalking was happening, there was criminal damage to my property. He was then put on bail conditions. That didn't stop him. Just because he was told not to do something, that didn't stop him. And what we need to understand is these aren't reasonable people. These are stalkers who have their own issues and they're obviously fixated and obsessed. So handing over a piece of paper isn't going to necessarily stop it happening.
So if there
and
was
often can escalate it.
So if there was one final plea you want to make to the government, here today in this interview, what would it be?
It would be to properly look at the whole holistic way we deal with domestic abuse and stalking. It's not about just putting sticking plasters on individual incidents that happen. Now we're talking about stranger stalking. Look, we need to have a robust system around the whole lot. So like sex offenders, we've got a sex offenders register, which works to a degree, but we know who sex offenders are. They're able to track and monitor that. Why aren't we doing the same for domestic abusers and stalkers?
Thank you so much. That was Zoe Dronfield, campaigner, author and domestic abuse survivor.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
Ali, we just heard there from Zoe Dronfield there about her thoughts on Labour's proposed plans to protect stalking victims. What do you make of what she said, and what do you make of the proposal?
Look, first of all, I think whenever we talk about, and we've done a lot of it on the show, which I'm happy about, sort of gender-based violence and crimes, I'm consistently shocked, maybe I shouldn't be, but I'm consistently shocked at how wide scale it is, like full-on crisis. I think you started it by saying one in five or one in six women over the age of 16, one in five women over the age of 16 in England and Wales have been the victim of stalking at least once. Something on that scale, and considering the violence women face, the harassment, both violent and non-violent crime numbers that we've spoken about on the show, it really is quite remarkable that this isn't a bigger political priority in Westminster. Now, I think part of the reason why that is the culture of Westminster reflects the culture on our streets, unfortunately, in that this sort of stuff is prevalent in the palaces of Westminster as well. So I guess overarching thing, I'm constantly surprised by how little airtime this sort of stuff gets in our political circles. I mean, Keir Starmer's just done his big priorities for the country and sort of gender-based violence, though in the past he has mentioned it, wasn't one of them. In terms of what Zoe said specifically, I'm again constantly struck by the lack of faith women often have in the police force and the lack of training that exists. I can't imagine anything scarier and more demoralizing than calling the police on a 999, which, like Zoe said, is you think your life is in danger, and them coming and laughing on the doorstep and not taking the issue seriously. Yeah. Why would you ever call them again? Why would you ever have any confidence in the police? And that, you know, I kind of speak about this, something which I do have experience with, which is in relation to hate crime. We say this, we often don't report it when instances of a hate crime happen because we have no faith in the police to actually follow it through or anything to happen. Surely the same is true of women. I mean, you tell me, like, you I imagine women speak to other women and say, listen, this is my experience, and that kind of demoralizes you into looking for help and support, right?
Yeah, I mean, even as we speak, you know, after we get off this show, I will have probably two new messages from this man who contacts me constantly on Instagram, sends me messages probably 20 a day. And he seems pretty harmless, so I don't really engage. But you know, that's kind of because it's like par for the course almost, you know, being a woman in the public eye, you kind of get used to this behavior
and you accept that's part of burden of being a woman.
And I'm in no way comparing what that is to what, you know, particularly Zoe has been through and other women, but I think it just shows how normalized, you're right, it can be, and actually how much shame and stigma there is around still reporting instances of sexualized gendered violence to the police.
But how can the police act if they're not trained on it? It's such a specific crime that requires specific sort of intelligence and knowledge to sort of engage with and interact at the right moment, to intervene, sorry, at the right moment. So, for example, I always take it back to counterterrorism unit, right? The amount of money that the government throws at counterterrorism police in terms of training, knowing that the right moment of intervention is, being able to spot it, all that kind of stuff. I'm not saying take that money away, but why isn't that same sort of funding
provided to... I completely agree with you. I thought that was a really good point you made. I mean, why aren't there specialist divisions, right? That's essentially what you're getting, isn't it? It's a division. You know, counterterrorism is an example of something that got such a huge political priority, when actually, and we've had a woman, you know, we've had women on this show arguing before, misogyny should be seen as an act of terrorism because it is against women every day.
Can I tell you an interesting fact about that, by the way?
Yeah.
The government's own report a couple of years ago, I'll try and find it and share it on my social. So if you're listening and interested, go on my socials, I'll try and find it and share it. The government's own, the intelligence community's own report found, you know what, the one crime that is the most common precursor to actual terrorism in this country is domestic violence. Mm. So the most common precursor in terms of crimes committed before you commit an act of terror in this country is domestic violence.
Yeah. Yeah, and often that's because misogyny goes hand in hand, I assume, with radical ideologies as well, extremist ideologies.
Yeah, but again, it's how can you expect the police... First of all, imagine what message it would send to the country about how seriously you're taking this if you create a national division on it, the confidence it would give women to engage, our ability to also track and monitor how we're doing at a national scale rather than individual crime scale, and the training it would provide police officers. Also, it allows us to funnel experts, voices like Zoe, who might not want to be a police officer but could help in this particular crime, to kind of gather their expertise.
Yeah.
The online bit is really interesting to me as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's particularly what I'm also interested in, is how you draw a distinction, because I can imagine if someone's showing up at your house, putting a bunch of flowers on your doorstep or smashing up your house or your car or whatever, isn't taken seriously by the police, then I can't imagine the reaction they get to a woman saying, this man is sending me hundreds of messages a day, ringing me, sending me anonymous hate. You know, it's just, we already know crime in that space is taken far less seriously.
And that's the other question, right? So if a man or anyone really exposes themselves to you on the tube, for example, if they, you know, I'm trying not to say it, but like exposes themselves.
Is fine.
Yeah. the police, if they see that, would rightly interact. Mm. But if they send you unsolicited pictures again and again of themselves online, no one acts.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, coming up, well, we know the justice system is currently on its knees, but we'll be taking a look at the family courts and the impact it's having on children and parents involved. All that and more next.
Foobar Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my SAS sister.
That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either, because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
You're listening to Foobar Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Foobar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for Foobar Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The Foobar Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you, what's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the cray, truth.
Cray.
And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle. I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Politics Uncensored on Foobar Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
It's a widely known fact that the criminal justice system is at capacity, with some cases taking up to 3 years to go to trial. However, family courts are also facing the same issue, with figures from the Ministry of Justice finding that over 100,000 children are trapped in the family court backlogs. Now, my amazingly talented co-host, Zoe, has done an amazing, brilliant piece on this. And you know it's a brilliant piece because when I read it, I learned so much about such a critical issue that if you had asked me in the 10 minutes preceding reading it, I would have nothing to know about. So, first of all, kudos on this piece.
Thank you.
A long piece that should have, I can only imagine, took an enormous amount of time. Can you give us the sort of headlines of what you found and why it was so important to write this piece, and then we'll go from there?
Yeah, so this story came to me from somebody I know who works with a number of lawyers, and they said to me, have you any idea what's going on in the family court system? It's a bit of the law that we don't talk about as much as, say, the criminal justice system, because it particularly involves children who, as we know, don't have an awful lot of political capital. They don't have a great...
Can't vote.
They don't have a voice, to be honest. But this particular part of the family court system involves parents who are getting access arrangement to their children. So it's often parents who are divorced, who are trying to get custody arrangements in place. And because of the 13, 14 years of underfunding of the Ministry of Justice, because of COVID, because of cuts to courts, just like the rest of the criminal justice system, those who really need it are now stranded within it. So there aren't enough staff. Courtrooms are falling down. Parents can't access legal aid. So if you're going through a divorce, you used to be able to get legal aid from the government. You can't pretty much anymore.
Oh, really?
No.
So what do you have to do?
So you have to fund your own lawyers.
Right.
So I spoke to a number of families who had spent upwards of £1 million in legal cases, trying to sort out access arrangements of their children. Now, it's a well-known fact that it kind of doesn't matter how amicable you are when you first separate, going into court can make things very difficult, especially when children are involved.
Yeah.
But the point of this is actually the delays that they're encountering are making things far worse. So not only is it causing relationships to deteriorate, people are spending far more money because every time they get a cancelled hearing, every time a judge doesn't show up, they have to spend more money on that.
And that therefore makes the case more complicated because relationships break down.
Absolutely. Yeah. It also means that if there is a power imbalance, if you have a particularly wealthy spouse or an abusive spouse, they can game the system to for their own advantage. So if you know, for example, that you have a spouse who doesn't have very much money and you want to go for full custody, it would be very easy for you as the wealthier spouse to just bring them back to hearing after hearing until they run out of money.
Crush them with money, basically.
Yeah, and they can't represent themselves anymore.
What do you do if you don't have the money? So you spoke about how much it can cost, and basically legal aid is almost non-existent. If I don't have that money, but I need to go through the court system.
So I spoke to people who sold their house, sold their possessions, just to go through this system.
And if you don't have that, do you represent yourself?
You represent yourself. So you can do self-representation. That is incredibly difficult. I mean, you know, to represent yourself in a court of law, especially when you are being, you know, your behaviour is under scrutiny. So if you're looking at access to children, obviously the main point of the court is to establish where the child is safe.
Yeah.
And I think this is particularly, and you know, I spoke to one woman, obviously I can't name anyone in this because they're ongoing legal issues, but one woman who had gone through the court process with a very abusive ex-partner, trying to get access to her child. And she had to end up self-representing. And, you know, she said it was so hard to keep up with the legal jargon, to figure out, you know, what she was supposed to say, what she was supposed to do. And it destroyed her. You know, it was a decade.
And I think your article has mentioned that there's been an increase of 30% of self-representation since 2013.
Yes.
And the Law Society of England and Wales analysed figures showing that 96% increase in cases without legal representation between 2016 and 2023. And that's obviously not at all optimal because of how complex these issues can get. In terms of real terms, I want to make this sort of the real crisis for people listening. What does this mean for the child? How long are they left in the system without any security, stability? What does that look like? If you, let's say you've gone into the system, how long can it take? What does that like?
So the average case is taking 11 months to complete, but that is for a fairly straightforward case. So this can be a case where the parents are generally both you know, pretty much in agreement about what the arrangement should be. And it tends to take about 11 months to get a court order, go through the courts, etc., get a hearing, etc. If you have a complex case, say, for example, where a parent requires drug testing, where there needs to be a report into the child's safety conducted by an independent body, if you have to have police disclosures, if you have to have hair strand tests. I spoke to some lawyers who, you know, they had cases going on for upwards of 5 years. And the point that some parents have made to me is actually, if it is that you are a parent and you are, you know, you have to have a hair strand test, for example, which shows whether you've got drugs or alcohol in your system, you might have your access to that child revoked until they have the results back. But you don't know how long that's going to take, right? Mm. And you are missing key milestones. So I spoke to a number of parents who told me they'd missed hearing their child's first words. They hadn't seen their child in a year. Their child had forgotten what they looked like. You know, really desperately sad things of relationships that actually, relationships break down and the court is there to help get through disagreements. But actually, this whole system is now making things far, far worse. Yeah. And, you know, it's a terrible irony that family courts are there to keep children safe, but they are causing parents' health to deteriorate. They are causing parents to sell their home and their possessions to pay for it. You know, they are creating a more unstable environment for that child.
So what we're talking about here is basically, if this occurs in the very infancy of a child being born, in worst case scenarios, a parent, if they're facing an abusive partner or a particularly complex case, can go 5 years not really in the life of that child the way that they would want to, the most formative years they could miss entirely.
Absolutely, that's entirely possible. And you know, it's worth saying, this piece is particularly about the private family court system, which is very specifically kind of child access arrangement, usually divorce proceedings. But there is also the public family courts.
What's the difference between
so private family courts, tends to deal with these particular disputes involving parents clashing over arrangement or access to children, and there's not so much state oversight. You kind of expect it. You're adults, you'll sort out your problem, you get on with it. That's why they don't...
Kind of like private mediation almost, right?
Almost, and they don't get legal aid. Public law is where local authorities are intervening in the matters of child protection. So that is when people have their children taken off them. Mm-hmm. And actually, another piece has been published today for the organisation I work for called The Lead, particularly about young women who are overwhelmingly more likely to have their children taken off them, particularly further north you get. There's a real correlation there. And there is also, you know, it's this lack of trauma-informed wraparound care. A lot of these women are very vulnerable. They might have addiction issues. They might have abusive partners. Mm. There is no support in there once they've had their child taken off them to help them get better. And so there are appalling case studies in this piece that's been published today of women having 3 or 4 children removed from them because they never got the support they needed again. And because they were so young when they had the first child, the system was just stacked against them.
And the data, I mean, consistently shows children do better with the with the parents anyway, and with as little instability as possible. So this is really hurting everyone on every scale.
Of course,
So the backlog is really what's at fault here. When we talk about the NHS, we kind of blame COVID often about the backlog, even though that's nonsense because there was a massive backlog before. How did this backlog start? Because you very clearly lay out the slashes to budgets starting in 2010. A 23% cut in the budget of the Ministry of Justice. How did this backlog start?
Yes.
Who can give me someone to blame?
Well, I think you can blame the Tories. You usually can. So, yes.
I'm good at doing that.
In 2010, when the government implemented their austerity agenda, they slashed a lot of government budgets, but the Ministry of Justice budget was slashed by almost a quarter, 23%. And this just triggered a cascade of challenges across the system. So delays, stagnant pay, poor working conditions, courtrooms that were falling down. There was some funding boost that came in. There was one during COVID, but the trend has been just overwhelmingly chronic underinvestment. And of course, we know, same as in the NHS, once that starts happening, staff leave. You know, so we have now a shortage of judges, shortage of barristers, and that means that it's very easy for you to have a court hearing scheduled and for it to just be cancelled because there's nobody there. Or another thing that happens is you have a court hearing scheduled, then you have another one scheduled in 4 months' time. It's a totally different judge. They've not read the papers. They've not had time. You're back to square one.
I'll be honest, it sounds a lot like the NHS, where you get an appointment, it gets cancelled, it gets pushed into next year, and then it gets pushed and pushed, and that is quite similar, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But it's like the NHS, if you paid unbelievable amounts every single time you had an appointment cancelled, you know? And I think that's the rates are extraordinary. You know, people talking about spending £1 million just to regain access to their child.
Yeah, and can I ask you a little bit about the inequality within the system? Mm. So it's, what I want to hear is basically you spoke a little bit about how the further north you get, the bigger the problem is with women having children taken away from them. The reason I didn't know this until I read your article is part of the reason why that's happening. So if you're richer and you're going through the system, do you have a slightly different experience than if you're poorer?
Yeah, I mean, if you're wealthier, obviously you have access to better lawyers, bigger legal teams.
But can you get your case seen quicker? Maybe your lawyers are good at getting that done.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously a lot of it, and you know, there's also lawyers have all sorts of skills that they can do. So some of them, you know, are very good at pushing for certain things, certain narratives, and often it depends on the judges. I think, you know, there's definitely an inequality between rich and poor. There's a geographical and regional inequality, but there's also a massive gender inequality. Mm-hmm. So I did speak to some parents, some fathers who had children, access to children removed from them, and who felt, you know, that they had been unfairly treated. But I also spoke to women as well who particularly talked about how abusive partners are very good at charming judges. Mm-hmm. And
who often tend to be men as
well. And what I think is a really important fact which distinguishes the family courts from the criminal justice system is that there is huge reporting restrictions around family courts. Only very, very recently, in late 2023, could reporters go into a family court case.
Right, okay.
And only in very certain ones. It was a trial and publish details on it, even highly anonymized. Mm-hmm. But it used to be that you just couldn't at all. So there were reports that there was corruption and gender bias and judges not taking coercion or domestic violence seriously. But no journalist could write about it.
So it can be exposed, can be held to account.
And now what we're hearing is those attitudes have been baked in, and the court delays make it very, very easy for an abusive spouse to game the system, essentially.
Yeah. And so obviously it's a crisis point. What do we need to do to fix it? Is it a case of just fixing the budgets that have been slashed and giving more money into the Ministry of Justice? What are people saying we need to do to fix this?
Well, I think everybody wants more money. You know, and this is a problem across public services. The Law Society has called for 11.3 million in civil legal aid, and it's particularly for early legal advice for people.
Sorry, I mean, that's actually a question I should have asked. You said legal aid doesn't exist now, barely exists now. Is that because the money's gone, basically?
Yes, the Tories slashed access to legal aid.
So that's an obvious place to intervene first, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, lawyers I spoke to said we need actually billions to redress the legal aid deficit. There are people who desperately need legal aid who can't access it. There's also CAFCAS, which is the independent organisation that looks after child's welfare. They have massive issues with retention, staff burnout. So, again, this is an issue. Same with local authorities. Other lawyers I spoke to said, actually, this is about training judges better on the dynamics of abuse and control so that they can see when this is happening. But, you know, also they all pointed out to me that courts become the place when people are having the most acute crises in their life. A lot of this is down to failures of the welfare state, poverty, want.
Intervention at an earlier stage.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's actually, much like all of these things, it's a holistic issue. Yeah. And although funding is desperately needed to keep the legal system going, what they actually say is we need to get much better at helping people with their relationships, with their lives, with, you know, all these issues that lead to family breakdown before they are at the acute point of crisis where they have to go to the courts.
Yeah, you know, what I think is interesting is just then when you were talking about how much money was needed, the sort of inflection you point on billions is presumably because that's a lot of money. But isn't politics just about the decisions we make and the priorities we have with how we spend our money? And if it's not on children being ripped away from their families and parents, mothers and fathers going through these crises of not seeing their kids for 5 years and being stuck in the system and losing access to your kids because your partner might be abusive or might have more money than you. If we don't spend it here, where do we spend it?
Absolutely. And, you know, the last thing I'll say is that's the point I made in the beginning of the article, which is that when there were the riots in summer, the government acted very, very fast to mobilise police, fast-track prosecutions and get judges working around the clock. it's a political choice to let these children sit stranded in the family court system.
Well, really amazing piece. I've learned so much about it. If you're listening, go and read it. It's on The Lead, national.thelead.uk, which you can find it. It's really fascinating. Go and seek it out. It'll be on Zoe's social media. That's it from Politics Uncensored today. Join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald, but only on Blue Sky and Instagram.
Yeah, she's left Elon. If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARradio.com or on the FUBAR Radio app. Download it now from your app store. Thanks for listening. Join us next week for a special Christmas episode as well, where I'll be wearing my Christmas jumper.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald.